I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Later in the hour, we talk with author Denise Kernan about her book, The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. But first, we sit down with two authors to discuss guilt, reconciliation, and what we can learn from the past. From our studios at WGBH in Boston, we welcome Rachel Kadish. She's the author of several novels. Her most recent is The Weight of Ink. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us from WGBH is Jessica Shattuck. Her most recent novel is The Women in the Castle. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel, your novel, The Weight of Ink, follows the story of two women. One woman is alive in the 1660s, the other in the 21st century. Would you kind of give us a synopsis of the plot?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start by saying I started writing the book because I was troubled by that question that Virginia Woolf posed, which was, if William Shakespeare had an equally talented sister, what would have been her fate? And Woolf very succinctly said, she died young, she never wrote a word. And that would have been the fate, most likely, of a woman in that era. But I kept thinking, what would it have taken for a woman with that kind of capacious mind not to die without writing a word? And so I wanted to write a story about a woman who manages to persist and live a life of the mind against all these odds. And so my novel opens in contemporary times when a 17th century house is being renovated and documents are found inside a stairwell. But there's something about these documents that is clearly off, and there are statements in them that are radical. And it turns out that the documents that are signed under a man's name, some of them were not written by a man. And so the story is weaves back and forth between the present time when contemporary historians are struggling to solve the mystery of who left these documents and the 17th century voice of Esther Velasquez, who is my character, 17th century character who left the documents and managed to do it through a grand deception.
Mm. Is there a passage that you'd like to read for us?
Sure. I'll read actually the first thing I wrote. And I started this when I didn't even know what the novel was going to be about, other than that I knew that there was a woman who refused to be silenced in the 17th century. And I started writing a voice of a woman who had something to confess. And I'll just read the opening of the novel. This
okay.
ended up being
That'd
the
be
first
great.
Couple paragraphs. June 8, 1691. 11 Sivan of the Hebrew year 5451. Richmond, Surrey. Let me begin afresh, perhaps this time to tell the truth, for in the biting hush of ink on paper, where truth ought raise its head and speak without fear, I have long lied. I have not to defend my actions, yet though my heart feels no remorse, my deeds would confess themselves to paper now as the least of tributes to him whom I once betrayed. In this silenced house, quill and ink do not resist the press of my hand, and paper does not flinch. Let these pages compass at last the truth, though none read them.
One of the difficulties of writing, from the 1660s is language. Language was so different. Was that difficult for you to kind of wrap your head around that? And what kind of research did you have to do?
Yes, I struggled with that enormously at first. I did a lot of research. I did a ton of research just into the details of daily life. But language was very specifically difficult. And I started out thinking that I needed to be absolutely accurate to the way people spoke at that time. And I would spend all this time studying these 17th century texts. But in truth, they used a very convoluted syntax, or to what to our ears sounds convoluted. And finally, I read this wonderful interview by the writer David Mitchell. And it was the most liberating thing. He talked about the idea of bygoneese. When you're writing a historical novel, you need to come up with a language that sounds old and isn't anachronistic, but you can't write exactly the way they spoke at that time because it would be very difficult for the modern reader. So once I figured that out, I used a more modern sentence structure, but I was very careful to only use words that were in use in the 17th century. So that's how I sorted it out. Yeah. It took a long time.
Yeah, but Jessica, your book, The Women in the Castle, takes place in Germany, mostly in the recent aftermath of World War II. So give us a synopsis of your plot.
So my story follows the lives of three German widows who come together in the June of 1945 in an abandoned castle in Bavaria and try to put their lives back together and raise their children and deal with the devastation of World War II. They are, at least ostensibly in the beginning of the book, they appear to be the three widows of members of the resistance, men who were executed for their role in the real 20th of July assassination attempt on Hitler's life that failed and did lead to many executions. The characters are wholly fictional, although I did a lot of research into the resistance, and they and took some inspiration from real members of the resistance. But these women come together and have to try to rebuild their lives. And as the story unfolds, you learn that they're not all exactly who they at first appeared to be. And in fact, their experiences and even beliefs kind of span the gamut of the political the political experience of Germans at that time. So the story kind of starts, it goes from 45 to 50, and then it jumps far ahead to the present in the very end, and you see them as old women.
Is there a passage that you'd like to read for us?
Yeah, this is actually a passage I've never read before, so would be kind of interesting. But I was trying to think of something short that really summed up something about the book, and it comes actually about two-thirds of the way through, and it sort of speaks to something that really is what led me to write this book, my own thought process on what it was like to be a German and have participated in World War II and then lived the rest of your life afterwards. This is from the point of view of Benita, who's one of the three widows. Once Benita closed the little slanted door to her room under the eaves and saw the plain wooden cross mounted on the wall, the brown shaded lamp and worn coverlet, she knew she would die if she sat down. So instead, she descended the stairs and walked through the dingy foyer and out into the street. The inn was located on a narrow pedestrian throughway, and people walked past, shuttling children home to supper, carrying marketing sacks. Benita felt raw and exposed. She was stripped of the love she had wrapped around her like a protective cloak. No more Franz, no more Martin. Suddenly, she saw everything in its harsh, naked state. She felt the pulse of lives lived inside the mean little houses she passed, selfish or generous, kind or unkind, ugly or tolerable, almost all of them sad. And she saw the histories of the people passing by like X-rays stamped on their faces, ugly, mutinous tracings of dark and light, a woman who had ratted out a neighbor, a man who had shot children, a soldier who had held his dying friend in his arms. Yet here they were, carrying groceries, holding children's hands, turning their collars up against the wind, as if their moments of truth, the decisions by which they would be judged and would judge themselves, hadn't already come and passed. What a sham this new German present was, an irrelevant time, a mad scramble to cast votes after the verdict had already been reached.
Jessica, your grandparents were members of the Nazi Party in Germany during World War II. What was your reaction when you found out?
It was less of a revelatory moment for me because I think I always knew that they had been, I guess, as a kid, I sort of thought of them as ordinary Germans, but I knew there was something shameful in that. As I got older and started asking more questions and spent a good deal of time interviewing my grandmother in college, I obviously put a much finer point on what it meant to have been ordinary Germans. And certainly it was something that I had to reckon with, and I could see my grandmother reckoning with herself. And I think it's been something that I've kind of wrestled with and has played different parts in my life for a long time.
How did your family talk about this part of their history?
Well, my mother came to America at 19 and never moved back to Germany and didn't even go back and visit for the first 6 years she was here. And she definitely raised me with a lot of a strong awareness of the Holocaust and of the German responsibility for World War II and a sense of shame about being German. So that was something that was kind of always out there on the table with my mother. With my grandparents, it was a little more complicated. My grandfather and I never really did speak much about that time. He was a very foreboding forbidding, figure, and did not invite questions or conversation on that topic. But my grandmother was unlike many people of her generation, and she actually really wanted to talk about it once you started to ask questions. She wanted to try to explain how she could have made such a terrible mistake. Mm.
Rachel, was World War II and the Holocaust something your family talked about?
Oh, absolutely. My mother was born on the run. Her parents survived the Holocaust on the run in Poland and Russia and Lithuania. And so it was always in the background. I never didn't know about it. My grandfather talked about it a great deal. And I think in part what I didn't say earlier, but that the 17th century character I wrote about is actually a Jewish woman from an Inquisition refugee community. And I think part of why I was drawn to the history of those Jewish refugees from the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisition is that they reminded me so much of the Holocaust refugees I grew up around.
Is there a particular story from your family that brought home the realities of life for Jews before and during World War II?
There are so many stories, of course, but one thing that always struck me was that my grandparents were very patriotic Poles. The first thing that my grandfather did August 31st of 39, when the German planes came in, was he went and he joined the Polish army because he felt that that was his role and his job. There were not enough uniforms to go around at that point, which was a good thing because when they had to disband, everyone in a uniform was shot. And my grandfather sort of ran in the other direction. But they very much felt their Polishness and were very proud. And then they were on the run for years. I mean, I heard these stories as a kid, so the details that stayed with me were maybe not the details you would think of as an adult, but I couldn't get over, you know, learning that my family, while they were on the run, they had to take refuge anywhere they could. And one night, the only place they could was an undertaker in a village, so the only place they could sleep was in coffins. So, you know, as a kid, I remember thinking,
be
I remember
scary.
That.
Now, before the two of you met, how much of the other person's history did you know? And when you finally did meet, were you apprehensive? Rachel, let's start with you.
I did not know that much of Jessica's story. We met through a writing group together, and I knew that Jessica's family was German. But it wasn't until she actually wrote a piece, an essay, a beautiful essay. Jessica, tell me if I'm getting the title of it wrong, but I think it was I Loved My Grandmother, But She Was a Nazi.
Yeah.
And of course, my grandmother was a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, and I thought, I mean, Jessica wrote so beautifully about it, and I thought, well, we're in this group together. We have the sort of, you know, start of a friendship. We don't know each other that well. We should talk about this, because if we don't talk about it, it's going to be this thing that we never talked about. So I forget the exact sequence, but I think I said, hey, let's go out to coffee. And we went and we sat in a cafe and we started talking. And I think the first couple minutes we were both very careful. And then once we started talking, there was so much to say. And somewhere along the line, we both sat back and said, what would our grandmothers have said if they had seen us sitting at this table together? Even what would our mothers, how would our mothers react? And that was the start of what's been an ongoing conversation. And I find an even more important and fortifying one given, you know, world events. Mm.
Jessica, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say, one thing that was really amazing, I remember coming away from that coffee, we went and sat down at Pete's and we had so much to say. It felt like we could have gone on and we both have kids and lives that we're trying to balance. And it was like, okay, we got to go. But we kept sort of one more minute of like, there was just a ton to talk about. And that was sort of what gave us the idea we wrote a little piece together about that conversation. And it was very illuminating in some ways to find how many similar things we had to discuss and ideas we had about this time. And
I mean, I think,
go ahead.
We had both thought a lot about guilt and responsibility and what place forgiveness does and doesn't have in this. We had both thought a lot about what we tell our children and how to sort of look honestly at the past and use it to move forward as opposed to being stuck in the past.
That was the question I was going to have for Jessica is did you or do you carry guilt about your family's past, even though you weren't alive?
Oh, I do. Yeah. And I always sort of felt that was actually kind of important. And I guess maybe I have an odd take on guilt, which is that it's not an entirely unconstructive emotion. I mean, it's a difficult one, but I'm always surprised when I talk to Germans of my generation and they say, why should I feel guilty? I wasn't even alive. And I feel like this is the least I can do is to carry some bit of guilt around with me and try to use that to fuel some sort of constructive action or conversation or whatever it is. But the idea of sort of leaving the past behind, I mean, we all carry our past with us, I think. And it feels dangerous to think that you can reinvent from scratch with every generation.
Yeah. A number of famous people have come forward to admit that their ancestors were slaveholders, and certainly there are many of us who are descendants from those who held racial or anti-Semitic views. And you sort of answered this, Jessica, but Rachel, I'd love your thoughts on why do you think people may want to bring this past to light, and do you think we have a responsibility to do so?
Absolutely. And I think responsibility to me is the key word. And Jessica and I have talked a little bit about those other, you know, big ideas of forgiveness and guilt. I think I'm not a fan of talking about forgiveness because it doesn't even make sense. You know, the people who did the things that could be forgiven or not forgiven are generally long gone. What we need to talk about is taking responsibility. And part of that is looking at the honest truth of who did what and what the impact was. And I'm even leery of the word guilt because it's sort of next door neighbor to shame. And I think I'm very focused on what moves us forward. And so shaming someone because they're related to someone who did something horrible isn't necessarily productive. And I'm interested in what's productive. And what's productive is to say, okay, what's your responsibility moving forward? And I think the more we know about the stories of the past, the more we see what one individual can do. And Jessica and I have talked a little bit about the feeling that, you know, it's so easy to have sometimes about powerlessness. But when you really look at those stories from the past and at who did what, I think one of the things that emerges is that when the world is going crazy and when bad things are going on, the only thing that makes any difference is an individual making a choice. And I feel this so strongly just from hearing my own family's stories, because let's say you have, you know, a family of people on the run, or Jews during the Holocaust hiding in a barn, right? It took dozens of people to keep their secret. It took the farmer and the farmer's family and the person who maybe noticed that extra medicine was being brought to the barn or something like that, or there were a lot of footprints in the mud. All those people had to individually choose to stay quiet, whereas it would take only one person to betray them and kill them all, one person to point the police in their direction. So when I think about things like that, I think about how much power each of us has as an individual. And I think it's so important to look at those stories and translate them into recognizing what our responsibility is now.
Jessica, your book shares the stories of Germans who were Nazis. The characters in your book are not evil. They're human. Why did you want to humanize German Nazis? And were you concerned about reactions from readers? And what has been the reaction?
Yeah, I was concerned. And I felt like that in many ways fueled my desire to write about it, because I realized as I tried to make sense of my own family history and to look at this time period, that there were not that many examples, at least in English literature, of stories of World War II that are told from the German perspective. And to me, that seems very dangerous. At the moment when I started writing, it was just what I wanted to do. And the fact that that wasn't out there sort of felt like a little scary, but a little bit inviting too. There was space for that. But it's also, to me, it seems very troubling to think that we don't get to see what was going on in the lives of ordinary Germans or Nazis. And when I say Nazis, I have to be clear that I'm talking about the sort of middle ground gray area of morally complicit, certainly culpable people, but who were not at the far end of, they were not the leaders. They were not, the concentration camp guards who were right up against and perpetrating the evil of the Holocaust firsthand. But these were people who were willfully blind or turning the other way. And my sense is that we have a lot to learn from those people, precisely because they were human beings who were capable of kindness as well as cruelty, and love as well as hate. And they had children and they had pets, and they lived their lives the same way any of us did. And to take their experience and put it in a sort of box that we don't look at because it's too complicated to get into, or we're worried that in humanizing them we somehow mitigate their guilt, lets us off the hook from looking at ourselves.
Yeah. Rachel, what are your thoughts?
If I can,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah. I I love hearing Jessica talk about that. And I have to say, as a granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, I'm grateful for Jessica's book because I think it is very clear to me that understanding people is not the same as forgiving. We don't have to worry that if we understand people, then we absolve them of, you know, of what they did. And having said that, it's really important to understand how people can become members of the Nazi Party. It doesn't do us any good. And again, I'm talking about looking toward the future. I'm talking about the sort of real meaning of never again. It doesn't do us any good to say Germans who joined the Nazi Party are space aliens. They're from another planet. They're nothing like us. They're not human. We don't have to worry about how they did that. That doesn't do us any good for the future because it means that the next time ordinary people join some fascist movement, we won't be able to comprehend it either. Mm-hmm. What's important is that we be able to understand how people who have their full share of good and bad inside them can be tempted by this kind of ideology or can choose to look the other way. And I think if you consider the complexity of people and the fact that we all have some internal tipping point where we could be tipped over to do something that is against our own inner moral compass, then it's really important to understand how that happens. Mm-hmm. I grew up being told, you know, some version of, you know, all Germans are evil. And I'm really grateful to read a novel about these complex characters. I think it's important.
Yeah. So this question to both of you. You're talking a little bit about how literature helps us understand our past, but also can impact our future. And my thought as you're talking about this is you're talking about understanding, but I'm also thinking there's a lot of in the younger generation who weren't around and really don't understand the atrocities that happened. So in a way, it's a form of education as well to remind us that this has happened in the past.
Yes, I grew up with my grandfather very specifically telling me, you know, when I was a 10-year-old kid, you need to hear these stories because we're all going to be gone and you need to hold on to these stories. I take that seriously. Having grown up around people who had been through this, who really carry the marks of it, it's really important to keep those stories going.
I totally agree with that and think that is a hugely important part of understanding and moving forward. But there is a part of me also that is interested in the idea that sometimes stories can get canonized. Mm-hmm. And when they are told again and again in the same way and you have the same characters representing the same good and evil, and it becomes allegorical rather than real. And I think that was something that I really wanted to work on in my book, was breaking through what started to me to seem like there is a danger of kind of a pat story when it gets repeated often enough and it isn't told with nuance. So I think that there's that, we're saying the same thing, but there's that kind of getting inside the story and opening it up from new directions and in new ways is something that we're really ready to do right now with World War II. And I think people are really hungry for that, too.
Yeah. Many people are drawing parallels between the nationalism of the 1930s and the nationalism that we see today in the U.S. and parts of Europe. What do you think we can learn from the circumstances in Germany in the 1930s that led to the rise of the Nazi Party that might help us combat the racism and anti-Semitism that has become more blatant in recent months?
Well, I think, I mean, I've thought about this a lot, and I think that there are both parallels and great differences, of course. But Germany at that time in the 1930s was full of both a feeling of being an empire in great decline. It had obviously had a huge setback in World War I, and the guilt and the reparations demanded of Germans were huge. And there were many people, especially in industrial sectors and working class populations, who were displaced by the French occupation of takeover of the German industry, which there was kind of a crisis that was not so dissimilar from what's happened in certain industrial sectors in America today, where people are looking at a kind of dying an industry that used to sustain them that no longer does. And I think that on a larger level, people were totally threatened by the sense of belonging to a large world that they didn't know quite what their place was in. And they were looking for a leader who would make them feel strong and proud again and who would answer really complicated questions with really simple answers that were easy to hang on to. And I think that is something that is alive today, and it's always a force in society. People always want simple. If you get someone with a really simple answer to a complicated question, there are a lot of people who are going to hang on to that.
Rachel?
I think Jessica spoke beautifully about it, but I think what was going through my head as you were asking the question was just one thing we have to have learned is that always take it seriously. Never say, there's a bunch of crackpots with, you know, this ideology, but, you know, it's just a few people. We don't have to take it seriously. Always take it seriously because that's where, you know, you see where that train is heading and you've got to keep an eye on it.
Rachel Kadish, her book is The Weight of Ink, and Jessica Shattuck, her novel is The Women in the Castle. We'll have links to both of their books at our website, capeandislands.org. And we should mention that Rachel will be at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation on October 17th at 7 p.m. Thanks also to Doug Shugarts and Tom Devlin for production assistance in Boston. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Coming up after a break, author Denise Kernan joins us, the author of The Girls of Atomic City, the untold story of the women who helped win World War II.